The theme for the evening talk is the process of change. In the Buddhist tradition, there is a fondness for relating the early life of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. And can I smell incense? That's a fire. Right. Sweet, burning fire. Right. And it's all right. Not necessary. Having given the title The Process of Change rather after that. And so there is a fondness for telling this story that at the age of 29, Siddhartha Gautama, having all the affluence and benefits of an extremely privileged lifestyle, began to feel an incredible degree of intensity of dissatisfaction. And as the old texts report from what he said that for the first time he saw an aging person, for the first time he saw a sick person, for the first time he saw a corpse, a funeral procession. And also, and finally, for the first time, he saw a wandering sadhu, a wandering monk, in search of some resolution to all of this. And for some, that the impact of such awareness is, as it were, for the first time ever seeing, can really strike a strong chord with people. And he took what might be seen as a rather alarming step, and that is, he went to his beautiful raven-haired wife Yashodhara in the night, and the young weak-old boy Rahula, and kissed his wife. And he recalled later in life to his close companions Sariputra that it was so difficult, the decision to break away from the privileges and the security and the wealth, and especially from his wife and young son, that he said he couldn't bear to pull the sheet back which was covering the boy in case it forced him to change his mind. And then he called Chana, his charioteer, and they rode out together to the edge of the city where they lived, Kapilvatu, of the Sakyan kingdom of North India, and got off the horse, and he said he cut his hair as a kind of last cutting away of his associations with his past, with his history, with his responsibilities, with his duties in terms of becoming the next king of that tiny principality, and left on what came to be regarded, or he regarded, as the noble quest. And people have said, you know, how could such a person do that? How could the Buddha do that? But one has to appreciate, I feel, and acknowledge that at the time he wasn't the Buddha at all, was a very confused, doubting, uncertain, and felt imprisoned into a situation. And he may not have been approaching 40 in terms of midlife crisis, but it sounds like he had an early midlife crisis as he approached 30. And I'm sure it's probably happened in history since and before, in terms of the departure from the conventions. And with that movement away, there was a whole process of change taking place. And in that process, as it's recorded, he underwent all sorts of extremes in various practices. And I was rather reminded of all of this this year in India, and one of two of you here were there. They have a huge religious festival, in this case in Haridwar, in the North India, called the Kumbh Mela. And all the religious traditions, going back centuries upon centuries, gather, and the main ones take place about every 12 years. And when I was a wandering sadhu, wandering monk in India in the 1970s, I attended one of these. The estimated numbers at these huge festivals is anything between 7 and 15 million people. And one has the Digambaras of the Jain sect, naked sadhus who have never cut their hair, and some never even cut their fingernail. They're way out there. And one has those who engage in fasting, and those who are doing intensive austere practices, and those who are engaged in service work, and those who are coming from the jungle and the caves, and tens of thousands of these. A huge, extensive festival which takes place. And I remember being there and participating, as I say, years ago. And what was wonderful to see and witness in all of this, that the very same practices which were taking place 2,500 years ago, exactly the same practices, were and are still taking place. And you and I have commented about the time about, we're in the Negev desert here, it's hot here. In some of these austere practices of purification, one saw some of these sadhus, these wandering ascetics, and I remember one having 10 fires around him built in the middle of nowhere, and sitting right in the middle of them in the heat of the midday sun with all these fires, sweat profusely pouring off him. Or the one who's had his hand up in the air for 10 years, can you imagine, as an austerity, these, you know, eccentric to the nth degree of them. The ones who have never touched an item of clothing through the whole year, summer, winter, monsoon, they've never touched a piece of cloth, living utterly and utterly naked, and of course the view of being the true renunciates. And in the Indian tradition, these renunciates, the sannyasins, which is the word for renunciation, they took with the guru, they went to the Ganges, they were ducked underwater in the Ganges, and when they came out, they took a vow, and the vow was that they would never make any claim for the rest of their life over property nor family, and they would find a way to live without fear. That was the vow that they took. That was the only vows that they were taking. So on this long tradition of hardcore, heavy-duty renunciation. And once, where one of the Jain monks, still taking place, just doing standing meditation, and just standing there, and the Buddha went up to him and said to him, "Why are you doing this standing meditation?" And he said, "It's my path of purification." And the Buddha said to him, please explain what you mean by just doing this standing meditation as the path of purification. And he said, by just doing this standing meditation, I'm not creating any new karma, I'm not doing any fresh actions, I'm not doing anything new, I'm not making new karma for myself, and by just standing and standing and standing and standing, I'm working out all my old karma. So whatever comes up in my standing, it just comes up, and I let it go, and it comes up, and I let it go, and then I'm gradually, systematically, day by day, exhausting and burning up all my karma. And when I've burnt up all my karma, I'll be a jiva mukti. Mukti means liberation, jiva, liberated in this very life. Jiva means life, living. The Buddha looked at him. This view is still propounded very strongly, working out one's old samskaras, working out one's old stuff, working out one's old history, or whatever, one's old karma. The view is still very, very, very strong. And the Buddha said to him, asked him questions. We took the inquiry, asked him questions. First question he asked him was, what percentage have you worked out? How much have you worked out? He said, Bhante means venerable one. Bhante, I don't know. How much have you got left to go? I'm not sure. How will you know when it's all exhausted? I don't know. So he says, you're doing this standing meditation, you don't know how much you've worked out, you don't know how much is left, and you don't know what will tell you when it is finished. And he said to him, this is strong word to use with him, useless effort and useless striving. And the poor Jain monk standing there in the heat all those days, weeks, months, years, firm belief of gradually exhausting and wearing it all out until he became a jiva mukti, a liberated one with nothing left, was left speechless. One might ask, what would your response be? What would your response be? When I was a monk, somewhat similar story. When monks have done five years of training in the, there are monks who are just scholar monks. I'm not talking about scholar monks. I'm talking about monks of very dedicated practice. The discipline was that one stayed with one's teacher in the monastery for 5 years. After a 5-year period, one was ready to leave the monastery and live an independent way of living. In the bhikkhu's life, wandering life. And some of the monks, of course, as it still takes place today, leave to go to the cave, go to the jungle, go to the hills, or go on what is called tudong, which means just walking. My teacher walked through all 72 provinces of Thailand during his wandering years. So monks, as people in the world of affluence, like to talk about five-star hotels. Monks like to talk about five-star caves, and caves which doesn't have snakes already living in it. Caves where it's where there's shade. Caves where it's not too far away from the village for alms, for food, and caves which keep dry. These are called five-star caves. And one of the monks from the forest monastery had 19 years previously made a vow that when he went to the cave, he would live in the cave for 20 years and would not speak to a person or see anybody for 20 years. Made this vow. And the way that he could do that was by going to the cave within the jungle in southern Thailand, going to the edge of the jungle, and would hang from a piece of rope his begging bowl there, so the animals wouldn't get to it. And lay people came every single morning. He left the bowl there at night. They came in the morning, filled the bowl up. He came later, took the bowl, and went back to his cave. So he didn't see a single human being, and the villagers knew they weren't to approach the cave. So he lived this way for 19 years. And then he got hemorrhoids. You know what hemorrhoids are? This is what happens after sitting for 19 years, I think. And so it was necessary for him to get some medical treatment, and he let go of the vow for 20 years. It was 19 years and something, and got medical treatment, then went back to the forest monastery where we were. So the monks at Wat Chai, at Wat Suan Mok, that means Mok is Moksha, that means the monastery of the Garden of Liberation, to 200 or 300 acres of forest where the monks were. Monks were very, very curious. 19 years. So the monks gathered around and wanted to ask him, 19 years without seeing anybody, strong curiosity, mostly to check out where the wisdom and the clarity was. This is what monks like to do. And he was very, very quiet, and actually had a hut. I remember being in the hut and talking with him right at the very far back of the forest, very still kept as remote as he possibly could. And then he said something very surprising to the monks. He said, the period of 19 years in the cave was a, quote-unquote, complete waste of time. And the monks were open mouthed. 19 years of such solitude and such aloneness, and not having seen a human being for this whole period of time, and he said it was a complete waste of time. It takes the breath away from my head. Why? Such a courageous and noble, or whatever, as well as possible patterns of escape, but of course, in such length of time, one can't escape oneself. You can escape others, but you can't escape what's inside. And no doubt he had to work and live and work his way through many, 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 many things. And his main statement was that kind of extended isolation was not the means for the finding and realizing what liberation was. It was not the means to do it. It had too much withdrawal in it, too much stepping back from, too much being away from. And when he came back to the monastery, he knew it. He knew it, and in a way that he knew it, because he was having to deal with other monks who kept bothering him. It's true. So sometimes in fanciful thinking, sometimes in we can go in a kind of imagination of, oh, wouldn't it be nice if I could? And in the very process of change, sometimes our imagination extends beyond its capacity. In other words, there is an interest in change, there is an interest in the process of change, but sometimes we can make a kind of gap. And we can make the gap so big, it saves us from changing. When the Buddha spoke to the Jain about his standing meditation, and the Jain just didn't know how to respond. The essential focus and message of the Buddha was much more, that much more has to be addressed than just standing. There's a dynamic which goes on with life. There's a dynamic which keeps meeting life. And there's something in common between that Jain monk 2,500 years ago, just standing in the belief of exhausting all the samskaras, that means all the karmic formations, and the monk who's in solitude, keeping absolutely away from all contact with other human beings. And yet, and this is where in the process of change, and certainly some of you, obviously not in such extreme circumstances, may well have had some strong and noticeable reflections over the days here, in which one has said to oneself, you know, there are changes which I need to make in my life, and it's a tiny minority which will pursue change in those kind of ways that I just referred to. Nobody, it's pretty well near that. And so if we, as I say, set up something too far away from who we are, then of course we'll stay stuck, because we've set ourselves a goal which is beyond the capacity of who we are at this present time, and therefore we can't do it. Therefore the teachings have reminded us that we take, literally, metaphorically and actually, one step at a time. What if I want to make a change in my life, about whatever it might be, whether I call it a dramatic change or whether I call it a minor change, in a way I've got to know myself just well enough to make the step. And the step has got to be made, as been said before here, as close to the here and now as possible, because that's when I've got the energy for it. And I've got to somehow say, yes, this change, therefore I've got to put it into application. Otherwise, as many have said to me over the years, in the same voice as that monk said when he came out of the cave, people have said to me, who are 50 and 60, I just stayed stuck in something safe, and you know, I hate to say this, but you know, I've wasted my life. I blew it. So it's not only monks who are saying this. I hear it regularly all over the planet, people saying, I've wasted it. And sometimes in the latter period of life, it's a terrible shake-up for a person when that kind of experience kind of explodes upon their consciousness. I wasted it, I blew it, I lost it, or whatever. All because I was, whatever, attached to my career, attached to making money, attached to being somebody in the world, or because I just had trying to please my parents, or whatever it was. I just wanted security, and I never was prepared to take risks. It's the same mind as the mind of the monk who spent the time in the cave. It's the same mind as the mind of the Jain who stood there month after month on one belief and then having it shattered. These things are not necessarily so far away from us as we sometimes think and imagine. I was in Northampton some years ago. Dear friend of mine was there, and there was a large mental hospital, and I think it's one of those stories that, you know, we've been hearing stories on the retreat, and sometimes those stories are kind of unforgettable because of the fact of the story, and unforgettable for its significance. And this was a rather tragic story of a young person, a young man travelling in his teens, I think he was 16, 17 years old, and travelling on one of the local buses, and impulsively on the bus put his hands up a woman's skirt. She then screamed, the police were called, and then he was charged with some minor sexual assault. There was a psychiatrist's report. The psychiatrist decided that he was unstable and immature, and was sent to the mental hospital. And in the period of time in the mental hospital, was given medication, the effect of which his condition got worse and worse. Because he felt he must be he is crazy, he has to be crazy, otherwise he wouldn't be in such a place. These terrible things happen to people in all sorts of situations. The result and the effect of that was that in the hierarchy of so-called mental illness, those on the top floor were considered the most seriously mentally ill. Those on the ground floor were considered those who were nearest to being able to be released to move back into society. He'd been on the top floor for several years and was terrified of getting out, terrified of making change or entering into any process of change. And one day, one of the staff came up with a very rather beautiful and effective idea. A member of the staff said, "Do you think you could make one single step from the far end of the corridor in the far room where you are towards the steps which go down to the next floor?" And so the agreement was he took one single step on that one day, and then they drew a chalk line in front. And then the next day, they came back, and he put his foot just where that chalk line was and made the next single step. And gradually, in this large mental hospital, through the corridors and down the stairs, one single step at a time, from the fifth, fourth, third, second floor down to the first floor, and gradually down, and gradually back out into society. The gap between what where he was at the far end of the corner with all people's... I went to the mental hospital and walked around there, and the tragic plight of the inner human condition there, and very long corridors, and just gradually. And it, not only a very touching young story, of this young man who was in his, by this time, in his mid-20s, and also adjusted and back entering into society again, but also I think an important reminder to each and every one of us never to underestimate day by day, step by step, as part of the process of change. Even if we would like, and if we would love to be able to say, "I'd really like to make a really big leap in my life and really make a really major change in my life," and some do, and are willing to go through that period of which sometimes is, and what makes up for some the difficulty is the transition from security to insecurity. That sometimes is the transition which is being made in the process of change. It's probable that if we take a good hard look at ourselves, that we could quite quickly and quite easily recognize within ourselves areas which require the process of change. And so it's not only having useful and beneficial resources, it's not only being clear about that, but sometimes, and obviously as we've done over the days, having connection with people who one knows have really made changes with their life. And that's showing itself in love, especially, of course, in awareness, in profound connectedness, and many of the themes that we have touched upon. And I do believe in that respect that we can often draw wonderful inspiration from such people. And what that might mean and sometimes does mean is looking around this world, wherever, and saying, well, what kind of people does one feel respectful? What kind of people does one feel contact with? What kind of people can one draw inspiration? And what one finds, if one's not kind of caught up in mythology, that with a little quiet persistence and a little determination and a little continuity, one can actually meet with anybody on this earth. Anybody. One's just got to work quietly and gradually and in a regular way, and one will make the contact. And sometimes from those meetings and contact, you know, inspiration comes. And there are some obviously remarkable men and women on this earth, and who are doing just extraordinary things with their lives. And as I say, sometimes we need the sustenance, we need the contact, we need to meet with these people, need to see these people, need to listen to these people, need to kind of feel their presence. And there are, as I say, wonderful people on this earth, and it's truly worthwhile making contact and association, because we kind of get inspired and say, gosh, the steps that can be made. So again, that might mean at times that amongst our good friends and close personal friends and family, may find that if we're in a process of change, rather difficult. You know, obviously it can be incredibly unsettling. You know, one says, well, thank you, but I'm off to India to do standing meditation, etc. So making for change process of change, that we shouldn't underestimate, even if we can't see it, where and in what ways and how it will lead. Sometimes we simply can't know. And if I may just kind of moment to speak of myself, when I sometimes say people come and do a 7-day retreat. My first retreat was 3 years and 3 months, and we started at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we could all hear the bell very well and very clearly, because the bell was an empty bomb from a B-52 bomber, which had fallen out of a plane over northern Thailand as it flew out of Udon, the American Air Force base, on its way to bomb Vietnamese people in the American war against the people of Vietnam. And so this bomb was found near a monastery, and the monks and the lay people were rather thrilled with the discovery, and now after defusing it, etc., sent it down right in the south of Thailand to our monastery. And so right by the Buddha image in the Dharma hall was this large empty bomb. And in the morning time at 5 o'clock, one would be on rota for a 3-month period, and 4 o'clock in the morning, and to hit the bomb, and had a beautiful sound to it, I have to say, and probably one of the most wonderful conversions in history. And so in all of that, just doing practice, doing exactly the same what you and I have been engaged in here over the days. Now, how could one possibly see at that time, you know, what use was this going to be to anybody? And sometimes the missionaries would come from southern Thailand, and the evangelists, and come to the monastery and make a direct line for myself as the only Westerner in the monastery, and they felt they needed to save me, and they didn't realize I needed to be saved from them. And all of that in the process of things, but just staying steady, but not knowing what it might mean. What it seemed to seem was monastic life, and one just had trust and faith in that. But I had no idea what might be next week, next month, next year, whatever. I could only take it a week at a time, a month at a time, a day at a day at a time, and just trust it felt okay, and to stay with the process of change. And on one of the rare excursions out of the monastery, I went up to Krung Thep, which means Bangkok, because my good mother was tired of waiting for me to come home, so rather bravely she flew to Bangkok to see me. And in our monastery, you know, we had the shaved head and the robe and everything, but in our monastery we weren't allowed to have footwear, and it was probably one of the only monasteries in the whole of Thailand where, and the teacher on the hot roads and the pathways just said, walk on it, you know, watch your mind, and sometimes etc. So when my mother saw me and she saw these other monks walking around Bangkok, she said, it's so typical of you, always want to be different. And she said, you haven't changed at all. So one afternoon I took her to in Bangkok they have this large monastery, and it's and it has in it the what is called the Temple of the Reclining Buddha. You know, one sees the Buddha in the four postures, sitting, walking, standing, reclining, and one was in the reclining posture. So it's about nearly 30 meters, this huge reclining statue, reclining Buddha. And just while showing her the reclining Buddha, two missionaries came up to me, and my mother is Roman Catholic, and I said a few times more Catholic than the Pope, and so the two missionaries came up, and the missionary said, gave his name, and he says, I'm a missionary in the American Armed Forces. I'm from Alabama, and I'm just flying in from Taiwan. And he said, what are you doing dressed up like that in curtains? I'm a Buddhist monk. Which is fairly obvious, we're all over the place. But anyway, so then he said, when I was 27 years old, my marriage was on the rocks and I was an alcoholic. But then the Lord Jesus came to my life and saved me, boy. And the Lord Jesus can do the same for you too. So I said, I'm a Buddhist monk in a Vipassana Insight Meditation Monastery, and 17 hours south of here on the train in Nakhon Si Thammarat province. We get alcoholics, broken marriages, terrorists, drug addicts, people in confusion, people who need to be in mental hospitals, coming and seeking refuge in the monastery, doing the practices, contact with the monks and nuns, and seeing their lives change beautifully. And the teachings offer that. He said, I don't believe you, boy. He said, you're the son of Satan. I turned to my mother. I said, if I am the son of Satan, who are you? Oh dear. And she says, I feel sick. I just need to sit down for a minute or two, etc. So sometimes in the process of change that goes on, whatever it might be, how easy and how quickly are we, as perhaps with the missionary, becoming so identified with benefits that he's got and experiences that he's had, and the end result of it is enormous arrogance, terrible conceit, and a condescending and patronizing view to other men and women who are engaged in the process of change, and being simply unable to appreciate it, simply unable to see how others can change and bring from the depths of their heart real love and real kindness and true awareness and compassion and wisdom in life. And so sometimes in the process of change that goes on and the benefits, how easy mind can fixate and attach and cling and hold, and all that extremism, all that arrogance and putting down and dismissing of others who are also acknowledging the process of change and what can take place. So all of this in the process of change, we look and with care both inwardly and outwardly, and sometimes it's a leap into the unknown. And some of you here, in talking to over the days, have shown very beautifully and commendably the willingness to take fresh steps and take fresh leaps in one's life. And sometimes all that one might know is what one is coming from, but not really know where it's going to lead. And that isn't easy, and anybody in those circumstances needs tremendous love and support for people in those transitions of life. And there are others of you who not in any phase in that way, but deeply connected and deeply committed to understanding the process of change and making steps and short steps, whatever they may be, but nevertheless one senses it's invaluable for oneself and hopefully in the long and short term for others as well. And the love of the appreciation of that, it becomes liberating and feels the freedom of that. And so sometimes that change is on the outer level. You know, as the Buddha initially, the initial change was on the outer level. And sometimes that's what's necessary. We may not like it. We may not approve of it. We may not understand how a person or persons can do that. But sometimes it's on the outer level. In this case, the person leaves the family. We should be careful not to rush to judgment too quickly on such circumstances. And sometimes it's not outer at all. The actual process of change, while keeping steady with one's various responsibilities and relationships in life, and keeping steady with them, the change is from within. And just from within. And sometimes it's from without and from within. And all of that requires us looking well and clearly at ourselves in this. And as I say, sometimes the love and the sense for all of this genuinely feels very, very freeing. We don't feel to be a prisoner to the mind. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings participate in the process of noble change. May all beings live a free and liberated life. So we'll have a quiet minute or two together, please.